Welcome to the Red Light Exposé podcast.
We are an international grassroots survivor-led circle.
Our goal is to counter the growing acceptance of sex work ideology.
We aim to raise awareness of the harms of commercializing sex,
meaning prostitution, porn, stripping, and BDSM.
Through honest, in-depth conversations,
we elevate voices often ignored and silenced.
Together, we're challenging stereotypes and dismantling myths.
We envision a healthier, safer society, especially for women and girls.
We appreciate your company on this journey.
Tanse, hello, and welcome to another episode of Red Light Exposé. My name is April Eve Weiberg, and I am an Indigenous survivor of commercialized sexual exploitation. Welcome, everyone, to today's incredibly special and heartfelt episode. I'm deeply honored and privileged to be joined by a remarkable woman, advocate, and mother, Kathy King. Kathy's story is one of unimaginable loss, profound love, and courage. Her daughter Kara's life was tragically stolen due to sexual exploitation, and Kathy has since transformed her grief into a movement for change. She is the co-author of When Men Buy Sex, Who Really Pays? And is a voice for families impacted by violence and a beacon of truth for those who often feel unseen. Kathy, thank you for your courage and for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Kathy, to begin, could you share with our listeners a little about Kara and the light she brought to this world?
Oh, wow. I guess like any mother, I thought my daughter was very special. She was just a bright, happy little girl who brought me much joy. I was a single parent at the time, so we faced challenges from the very beginning. Her father and I did not have a lasting relationship. I guess we were both optimistic is what I could say. There was just her and me against the world in the early days, and I was a working mom, and I was fortunate to get excellent childcare and excellent daycare, and just enjoyed so much watching her learn and watching her grow as a child and all of her interests and watching her learn to do things and watching her make friends. She loved spending time at my parents' farm. She loved being outside. She loved horses. It just opened up a whole new world, and I quite enjoyed reliving my world through the eyes of a child.
Thank you for that. And I know our listeners can't see us right now, but just watching you describe what you just shared, your eyes, your face just lit up, just so much love for your daughter. And I really appreciate you being so open to sharing what's so personal. When you think about your daughter today, what is one of the first memories that come to your heart?
Oh, I guess it's not so much a memory, but an image. I keep finding pictures, and so many of the pictures, she just has such a bright, engaging smile. She had a smile that light up the world. She had her bad days, of course, but she had a bright, happy personality for the most part. She enjoyed making friends. She seemed to make friends easily. She just had an indomitable spirit and just seemed to charge ahead through all her challenges. And it's her smile, I think, that I remember, that I miss the most.
I'm going to dive a bit deeper. Many people hear the word sexual exploitation without truly understanding the layers beneath it. From your own experience, what do you wish more people understood about how young women like myself and Kara become vulnerable to that type of exploitation?
Yeah. Okay, that takes me way back. And I think about 20 years ago when I first started speaking, it was about vulnerability. It wasn't so much about sexual exploitation. I think what's always bothered me about sexual exploitation is that the young women are blamed. And I just think that is so wrong because, I mean, like with our book, it's like, who really pays? And it's like, who is doing the exploiting? Throughout history, we know that women have been blamed for their own sexual exploitation. I was sort of remembering back, I have some notes, if you'll indulge me, from some talks I gave probably 20 years ago. And in it, what I did at the time was identify some of the layers of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And these were all of the things that came together in my daughter's life that I didn't expect when she was a little baby, that I didn't realize as she was growing up. And one individually can impact how a child becomes more vulnerable. And when you put a lot of them together, of course, it's that much worse. And the first thread that I entangled was learning disabilities. And that was one of the things that I sort of knew that my daughter was not an academic, which was, you know, I am. And so, I mean, that was one of our first differences. She tolerated school. It wasn't her favorite place to be, you know, so I just encouraged her to do as well as she could. But as she grew older, then I just realized that she just didn't have the same abilities to succeed, to explore careers. For any young person who lacks that basic ability, it's a serious challenge for people. And for people that are adventurous and impulsive and fun-loving, that can lead them to sort of dangerous paths. The second vulnerability that I've named, well, I called it neurological disorders. Now, my daughter was an FASD, although she sometimes acted like she was. I've met women who are fetal alcohol, and just their inability to understand abstract concepts or inability to formulate consequences, just all of the things that go with fetal alcohol and related disorders. So I truly believe that there is a whole range of neurological disorders that aren't necessarily just FASD. And now the wonderful word is neurodivergent. Mm-hmm. Neurodivergent. That was a word that I didn't grow up with. And I love that word because it explains the diversity that we're not all neurologically alike. And some young people are neurologically challenged. So for them as well, they're much more vulnerable because they're not able to cope the same way some of the other of us do. Social deficits. And again, that's something we both know about. Such a general category of how is our self-identity and our confidence and our self-esteem formed? And if we've been in abusive homes, if we've been in poverty situations, if we've been in disadvantaged situations of many different kinds, we can grow up feeling lacking. Right. And when we feel lacking, we're more vulnerable as well, because everyone is searching for a place to belong and a place to make their own mark and a place to be accepted. It's certainly much more difficult for people who are experiencing other deficits to, I think, to sort of feel comfortable proceeding in what we call a mainstream world. Addictions, everybody's talking about how do we prevent our children from being caught up in the world of drugs that is so rampant. I won't even go into it because it's just too big. But we know that when some young people get involved in addictions, become addicted to various substances, that leads them to want to find money. And that makes them very vulnerable to other so-called friends who don't have their best interests at heart to say, hey, I know how we can make some money. And I think my daughter was caught up in that, which is something that I deeply, deeply regret that I didn't see it or understand it at the time. Mental illness, of course, nobody chooses to be mentally ill. Some people, a minority of people, I've learned, mental illness is triggered by drug use. Not always, but for some, then there's what they call drug-induced psychosis. And then what's so frustrating about that is that then the young people are blamed for their own psychosis, which is very frustrating when you're trying to get psychiatric help and told that it's the person's own fault. Homelessness, of course, is a major vulnerability. And this is something I used to say too. It is one of the most difficult situations imaginable to not to be able to offer shelter to your own child. And I know as a later teen, I struggled with that. I tried to secure accommodation for my daughter other than my own home because, well, I was at the time a single parent again. And it's not that I couldn't trust her. I would have been okay leaving her at home while I was at work, but I couldn't trust her discernment. Like I couldn't trust the friends she let into the house when I was away. And so I tried to get her better supported living. I tried to get her into her own accommodation. I tried many, many different ways to sort of get her accommodated with varying degrees of success. And so that basic housing security is a big, big factor in vulnerability. And then the other thing, of course, is incarceration. Through all of that, as young people are being blamed for their own vulnerability, if they are misfortunate enough to be charged and convicted, then a criminal record is added to their employment challenges. And that is just so, so unfair. And that's something that a lot of young women faced in past years, not so much now because the Canadian law changed. But in the earlier days, it was the young women that were charged. when there was sexual exploitation, they were charged for their own exploitation. The men, the buyers, the consumers were treated as victims. And so young, emaciated, spaced out, vulnerable women were charged with communicating, enticing these so-called citizens of Canada. And they were the victims. And these young, vulnerable women were criminalized, mm-hmm. which just added to the vulnerability. So it's so mm-hmm. complex. Each one of those factors, we could spend an hour probably talking mm-hmm. about each one. So they all kind of swirl around together, and it's very difficult for a parent to negotiate that. And then once the child turns 18, they're considered an adult. They're considered to be responsible for themselves. So if you've got an 18-year-old who's functioning with like a 12-year-old ability, she's still considered illegally an adult. And she's tried as an adult, she's judged as an adult. And then the parent, you don't have rights because you don't have parental rights of an adult child. Mm-hmm. And so then that makes it even more frustrating for the parent. And I know that that's a whole mouthful I've just come up with, but it's just a glimpse of how complicated my life and her mm-hmm. life was 25 years ago.
I know you've touched on this already, but could you speak a bit more about some of those systemic failures in regards to particularly law enforcement?
Yeah.
This is, I guess, law enforcement's involvement prior to Kara going missing.
Yeah. Well, and then, I forget the date, but it would have been probably about 1995. She was charged with soliciting, and I was sitting in court, and I'm thinking, like, am I the only one in this room that gets it? So here's this emaciated, spaced out, I think she had come to court from the psychiatric hospital because she was having one of her drug-induced psychotic episodes. Mm-hmm. So she's in court. The policeman, who is a very large, dare I say, ugly, I don't usually like to shame people's looks, but here was this man who looked like a monster, really. He was huge. He was not a handsome man, not the kind of man that anyone would have any attraction to. And he was like three times her size and twice her intelligence by any obvious observation. And he's testifying to the court, to the male judge and a male prosecutor. And this policeman, who was undercovering as a pervert, said, so they see this girl leaning up against a lamppost. And his partner said, she doesn't look well. Maybe we should call an ambulance. And he said, no, let's bust her. And so he goes up to her and he says, how much for over? And she says, I'm not talking to you, you're a cop. And he says, no, I'm not a cop. He says, you don't have to talk to me. Just show me with your fingers. How many $20 bills do I need for a blow? And she must have raised a few fingers or something, because that was considered communication. And she was arrested and charged, and she was sentenced to jail. And I'm sitting there in court, absolutely in shock, thinking, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be. And I think that was probably one of the turning points of my life 30 years ago now. That was considered justice,
right?
That this man, even if he was a real pervert rather than a pretend pervert, how was he the victim? Mm-hmm. And how was she the criminal? Why was the court protecting him? Mm-hmm. And what right did he have to try to buy sex from a vulnerable young woman? I just sat there in shock, and I'm just thinking, obviously nobody else in this room gets it. The male judge, the male policeman, the male prosecutor, mm-hmm. the male, I guess she probably had a student legal counsel, and it was just unbelievable. That was my experience of the legal system 30 years ago. I thought that the mental health system might be of some support, but they weren't either, because the defense asked for a report from her psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said something about she was difficult to treat, so they didn't know what to do with her either. So they didn't have any objections to a jail sentence. So that was the legal system. That was the public perception. I mean, one would have to assume at the time that the law was representing the public perception.
Right. You're listening to an excerpt from the Red Light Exposé podcast. If you're interested in hearing this episode in full, and generally want more deep dives into the subject of commercial sexual exploitation, you can find us at redlightexpose.com. And now, back to the excerpt.
One of the other ties that we have is the work that we've done and continue to do for the Center to Empower All Sexually Exploited. When I first heard about them, I was newly exited. They at that time went by the acronym PAFE. And then from there, it evolved to the Center to
End Sexual Exploitation. Yes.
Right. In these circles, have you seen any improvements from law enforcement and public perception when faced with a young woman that is in this vulnerable state?
Yes. And I guess I have to say 30 years ago, I mean, that's when I began my volunteer involvement with what I call CISA, but it was then PAFE. They were the only people 30 years ago that seemed to get it. Mm-hmm. And I had met Kate Quinn, who is, you probably have the opportunity to interview her. I must have met her in 1998. It was a public presentation anyway, because it was after Kara died. And she was presenting some of these sort of concepts and to a group of students. And when she was talking about the John School and the education that they give to the men, the law changed so that the communication was gender neutral and activity specific, so that it wasn't just the women that were charged. I remember on the police website at the time, they said they tried to be fair, which meant that they charged an equal number of men and an equal number of women. Okay, so things have shifted definitely over the last 30 years. So this would have been 1998, which is still quite a while ago. And I remember going up to Kate Quinn and saying, I'd like to speak to the Johns sometime. And she sort of looked at me and said, who are you? And why do you want to speak to the Johns? And I sort of explained my story. And Kara's story had been in the paper quite a bit around that time. And then she sort of took a step back and she said, oh, of course, I'm really sorry. And all of our volunteers are required to observe a full day before they are accepted as volunteers. So I said, okay, I'll come. This is something I just feel I have a story to tell. And I think they need to hear it. That was the beginning of my volunteer work way back in 1998. And so I've had, yes, almost 30 years experience in volunteering with CIS and all of the work that they do. And I've spoken to probably thousands of Johns over the years and have shared my story many, many times. And somebody said to me once, is it still helping you to go? And I said, no, I don't think it's about me anymore. Mm-hmm. I said, the only reason I keep going back is because I think it does make a difference. And at least some of the guys get it when they hear it.
Right.
You know, there's lots of things that they get. It's a full day of education. But I think my story does make an impact. You were asking about CIS and, oh, has there been changes over the years? Mm-hmm. Yes, there have been. And of course, the biggest change was the legislative change, the Protection of Exploited Persons and Communities Act, which criminalized the purchase of sexual services. And this was just absolutely groundbreaking. It was a, you know, continuation of the Nordic model. I just thought Canada has joined the 21st century. Like, this is revolutionary. This is good. We're getting it as a country. We're getting it. Unfortunately, the government changed the next year and the FASEPA legislation, as you know, has been largely ignored. So of course, across police jurisdictions, across Canada, everywhere where, you know, law is taught, people know that there has been a change in law. There has been a change in enforcement. It hasn't been developed across Canada the way I would like to have seen it done. It hasn't been enforced across Canada the way I would like to have seen. And there hasn't been the full development of support services to support the legislation that I would like to see either, because prosecuting offenders is just one small part of it. There have to be better exit opportunities for women who are already exploited. Mm-hmm. There has to be housing, shelter, childcare, economic security, employment, all the things that we talked about in vulnerabilities. And as well, there has to be prevention. You know, there has to be work done with the vulnerable population before they're exploited, just rather than to put all the blame on parents or the children for not knowing.
And just to go back a bit regarding the John School experience, can you share what some of those telltale signs were when you noticed a shift in the buyer?
Oh, in the buyers. Well, it would be really interesting. Yes. Well, even the very first John School that I went to, when I didn't speak, there was one fellow at the end of the day who stood up and said, "Thank you for opening my eyes, and I'd like to apologize on behalf of everyone here. I realize now that what I did was very selfish and very foolish, and you won't be seeing me on the streets again, and thank you for this opportunity," which is amazing. That kind of reflection I just saw repeated over and over and over and over again. There were times when we had education sessions like monthly, depending on police budgets and police philosophies from year to year. There's been more stings some years than other years. And anyway, it's very complicated. It works wonderfully when it's allowed to happen. I wish we could have more, but I also wish that the education could be taken to a broader level. But just to go back to the John schools, like most of the guys come in the morning kind of with a chip on their shoulder and like, oh God, you know, rolling their eyes, like I got to be here for the day. And we generally find that as the day goes by and there's education about health risks, there's education about the legislation, there's education about pimping, there's education about addictions, there's a lot of personal stories shared, there's education about community impact, and then there's survivor stories. And by the end of the day, the men are generally much more thoughtful, much more reflective, and sometimes they cry. I've seen a few grown men cry and have tears in their eyes. And when they say they're sorry, it comes from a place of honesty. And we know that they got it. Right. They got the message. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
I know our advocate sister, warrior sister, Andrea Hines, speaks a lot about labor language.
Yes. Yes.
And I myself catch myself still using kind of those incorrect outdated terms that really do protect the buyers.
Yes, yes. Right? They call it they're called customers. They're called
I would hope, and maybe I'll have to push a bit, but I think even with the term John School, let's just call it what it is. These are schools for sex buyers.
Or sex offenders. And right. now it's called STOP, Sex Trade Offender Program.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, yeah. So it's been renamed.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have permission to share this. Yeah. One of my former pimps, he was targeted and groomed to become a pimp.
I
think sometimes we forget in society that our men and our boys are also being targeted and groomed to become sex buyers, to become pimps, or both. And a lot of that has to do with what we're seeing in many forms of media, right? Yeah. Whether it's the music, you know, social media is very hypersexualized, very objectifying of women and young women.
Well, I guess what I find even most disturbing is that some seemingly well-meaning agencies and institutions are promoting the purchase of sex as a means of equality. And that I get nauseous. I'm shocked. And I just cannot believe that people are seriously saying that allowing yourself to be exploited is a justifiable way of achieving economic equality. Like it just does not, it's just so wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's so hurtful, and it angers me, and it makes me ill. And that is so pervasive. That is pervasive at so many levels of government. Well, I mean, our own city of Edmonton has what they call body rub centers, which basically protect sex offenders from federal legislation. And there's no way around it. And they say that, oh, no, there's no conflict between the bylaws and federal legislation. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the words they use and the manipulation of language and the manipulation of intent. And nobody's getting it. Mm-hmm. But it's like I was saying to Andrea once, it's like promoting dental care in slavery. Nobody is saying that slaves don't deserve dental care, but I guess kind of missing the point.
Right.
And across Canada, there's only one city and one town in Canada that have made a conscious effort to align their bylaws with the federal legislation. Two in all of Canada that have got the message and have chosen to consciously align themselves with federal legislation.
And being someone who has survived those licensed brothels, often the way the buyer would see it is they're walking in, they see a woman manager and women there, but not realizing that the actual owner's a guy and he's connected to organized crime.
Often, because that's the case.
For me, often sexual exploitation is organized crime. Yeah. Some well-organized, some
not so
very
well.
Unorganized. but it's still organized crime. It's still racketeering. Yeah. It's still money laundering.
It's still exploitation of the vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally agree. As someone once sold in those walls, I believe that we need to start calling what has been called illicit body rub centers, calling it what they really are, which are licensed brothels.
Licensed brothels, exactly.
And any of those people that are claiming this harm reduction philosophy, you need to hear from survivors like me that have been attacked, that have had some horrendous things happen, very traumatic things happen within those walls.
I totally agree. They need to hear that they're missing the point, and you can say it more clearly than I can. It's just very upsetting that there's divisions when we're all supposedly working for women's equality, women's empowerment, women's human rights. And then for some people who are supposedly on our side to say, but it's okay if women want to exploit themselves for money, if that gives them a sense of empowerment, that's okay.
Right. And that's the thing. Often the women that are actively being sold, the research is being done while they're actively involved in that lifestyle. And it sometimes it takes years to understand, even after exiting, what really happened.
What really happened. And of course, you're defensive when you're involved in it. Of course, you're defensive.
So many forms of brainwashing and the normalization of this is great. I don't necessarily see it as the other camp, because I don't want to polarize my sisters, because at the end of the day, those are still my sisters.
Exactly.
And I was once like them. Brainwashed to believe that what I was doing was my choice, but yet I didn't understand the perfect storm that occurred for me as a young child growing up in violence and substance abuse and all types of abuse, which led me to become a very angry teenager, homeless on the streets of Edmonton, which led me to have a circle of friends that were actually not my friends and did not have my best interests in mind, and seeing me as a young, vulnerable girl that they could exploit, which led me into the commercial sex trade.
Right.
Or commercial sexual exploitation. There's me going again with the labor language. I'm just really impressed, like the courage that you have. And I think you're definitely inspiring other bereaved parents and parents going through the horrific experience of seeing their loved one go down this path, and keep sharing your voice.
Thank you.
And speaking of which, we know that you've become a fierce advocate for change. Mm-hmm. I remember when we both gave our testimony during the National Inquiry's truth-gathering process in Edmonton in 2017. Since then, you've done numerous actions, one being, as mentioned earlier in the podcast, co-authoring the book, When Men Buy Sex, Who Really Pays. What truths do you feel need to be brought to the surface?
About the book, that was Andrea's challenge to me in early 2021. Anyway, she said, what Canada needs is a really good book. Are you in? And I said, sure. So it was a 3-year labor of love. Yeah, 21, 22, 23, I guess. Yeah, 3 years we worked on that book every day, at least. Every other day we were on the phone. Oh, just when I think of it, just from creating the framework to doing the research, for anybody that hasn't read it, if I say so myself, it's a well done book. There's tons of research. There's tons of personal experience. We consulted probably every other day for 3 years. And then we finally published. And then our publishers warned us that we should probably be prepared to spend as much time promoting as we did writing. So I said, oh, well, that'll... Now we know what we're doing till the end of 2027. Mm-hmm. So we're just finishing our first year of promotion. I think we've done okay. You know, we obviously don't have 10,000, which is what you need apparently to be a bestseller, but we're making a lot of inroads. We've had some encouraging purchases. Mm-hmm. Our aim was a classic. So our hope is that this book will still be meaningful 10 years from now, that people will still be referring to it, that it will join very humbly in the ranks of Rachel Moran. That was one of the game changes for me, reading her book. I don't pretend to be as good an author as she was, but there's a few. There's maybe, you know, 10 or 20 good books. We hope we'll be one of them.
Yes, I believe it will.
I hope so. Thank you.
Segue into a shameless plug. Where can our listeners go to get their own copy?
Okay. When Men Buy Sex.ca. Order it from the website. Yes, the more you order, the cheaper postage is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is why we stockpile a few in our own home for local buyers, because if you buy one book, they charge you $20 postage or $20 delivery charge. But if you buy 100 books, like, it's only $100 delivery charge. So,
well,
you know.
Who knows what's next, Kathy, because this is a global movement of survivors coming together. Like what you see with the work from Red Light Exposé.
Yes, yeah.
You very well, you and Andrea could become New York Times best-selling authors.
Well, so that would be
manifesting.
That would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Andrea, I've passed the torch to a certain extent because I'm getting tired. I've been doing this for 30 years, and Andrea's brilliant, and she is energetic, and she just has what it takes to take it forward for another 10 or 20 years. So it was a fortuitous meeting. We met at a John School. We met at a John School and we were, you know, inspired by each other, and we did a few projects together, and then she said, let's write a book.
Right.
I said, oh, sure. You know, whatever. It's COVID. We're not doing anything anyway, you know.
And it gets me thinking about, we carry as family members and survivors so much grief, and there's so much injustice. Yeah. We see more injustice than we see justice. And I think it's that, those kind of glimmers where it shows the beauty of our community, you know, working together and supporting each other. And another project I wanted to mention for our listeners today is Andrea's Labeled docuseries.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I wanted to just get some comments from you about Labeled Episode 5, The Missing, Murdered, and Forgotten. The award-winning.
Yes, yes, the award-winning. Oh, my goodness.
Both were in and shared some of our story. What types of feelings did you have in the beginning when we started to hear that it was picking up domestically and then internationally?
Oh,
with different awards and recognition.
Thrilled, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember. Yes, that was, people might wonder, why were you interviewed outside? It's because it was COVID. So there was an interview on my deck, and then an interview, and then some shots from the graveyard.
And the red dress.
Kira's red dress hovering above her plaque at the cemetery. Yeah, that was just a symbol again, as I say it. Yes, thrilled that it was recognized, that it's been shown a number of times. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what the future is. I haven't seen the whole series. Okay. I mean, I was involved in various parts of production. We've been so busy on so many fronts that it's sometimes hard to remember what's next or what we did last week. Yeah. It's an example of Andrea's creativity that far exceeds mine, and that she's writing a book and she's executive producing a docuseries at the same time. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. And she's working on a bachelor's degree and she's raising three children and she runs. Like, it's like, oh my goodness.
Okichitawak, warrior woman.
Warrior woman. Oh my goodness.
But so are you, my dear.
Oh, thank you. Mine feels more like reparation. You know, it's like, I guess my biggest regret is that I couldn't save my daughter, you know, and I look back and all those, you know, what I wish I had known 30 years ago, what I wish I might have done differently. We can't change the past, but we can only change the future. So I've just thought it's too late to save her, but hopefully I can save someone else.
Right. And you have, and you are.
And I hope so. And thank you. Yeah.
And just to pay honorable mention to the young Métis artist, Jamie Black, who started the red dress movement by hanging red dresses to represent our missing or murdered women and girls in public spaces.
Yes, absolutely.
It is very symbolic. It's a powerful movement that's part of this very large community coming together and saying no.
I have to mention the wonderful senior lady, Mufti Mathewson, who was reading the Globe and Mail one day. She was reading about the red dresses and said, I do care, but what can I do? And then she said, I know what I can do. I'm a photographer. She was a retired physiotherapist, but an active photographer. Mm-hmm. And she belonged to a photography club. And she got together a bunch of her friends and they started hanging red dresses and taking photos. And she developed a whole exhibit. And it was the Red Dress Photography Project. And then I met her at a criminology conference and went up to her again and said, I'd like to join your project. And so we met and I joined her on a few photo shoots and became quite involved with the photography project for a couple of years. So again, it was just a nice reflection and reaffirmation of some of the work that I was doing being picked up and expressed on a different level.
And we know that femicide is a global issue, a very serious and global issue. Now, you're familiar with the National Inquiry's 231 Calls for Justice.
Right.
I myself get asked by a lot of non-Indigenous North American people, how can we lend our voice, or what can we do to help stop this human rights crisis of missing, murdered, and exploited Indigenous people? And I think sometimes when we look at rights documents such as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's 94 Calls to Action and the National Inquiry's 231 Calls for Justice, it seems very daunting and probably overwhelming. My advice to those that are willing to look at those documents, pick three that you think are manageable.
Pick something.
Exactly.
Yeah, pick something.
Because I think a lot of us from our community were worried after we provided our testimony that this report that came out in 2019, June 3rd of 2019, would
6 years already.
You know, all of this labor of love and the sharing of what's so personal could end up another document on a shelf collecting dust.
And it's a wonderful document. I did read it. And I just want to add this for those who don't know. I also, a few years ago, might be 10 years ago already, I started a website, Missing Cara, C-A-R-A. missingcara.ca. So what it is it's a multifaceted website. It's been a little bit neglected the last year, unfortunately, but there's a lot that's still there that's still very good. There's four documents called the Seasons of Life, and each season contains daily reflections. And then over and above that, there's blogs. So what reminded me of that is that one of the things that I did is I, back in 2019, 2020, is as I was reading through the Missing and Murdered, the MMIWG document, is I summarized it and gave reflections on my blog. So the missingcara.ca, if you go to the blogs and go back to 2019 and 2020, you'll see under the monthly titles, you'll see some reflections on the document. So that was one of the things that I did at the time, just to create awareness. My website got a little bit neglected while I was working on the book. And then with the subsequent promotions, that's another one of my goals, is to revive my blogs. And anyway, missingcara.ca is still registered. It's still there. There's a lot of really good material on it. It's free. The book may cost you $25 to $40. Missingcara.ca is free. I encourage you to read both.
As a mother and advocate, what has been the hardest part of this journey for you? What has been the most healing?
Healing. Okay. The hardest part, I guess, is just stumbling over my own regret. You know, it's just thinking, if I'm a healer and an educator and an advocate, like, what could I have done differently 30 years ago? So that's my biggest regret, is that I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure it out well enough to save her 30 years ago. So the biggest healing, I guess it's just an ongoing process, because it feels, like I said, it feels like reparation. It almost feels like penance. You know, I failed in what was most important to me, so I'm trying to make it up. And I'm hoping it's enough. You know, sometimes it feels like it isn't enough, but then it feels like nothing would be enough. So that's why I just have to keep plugging away and just thinking, okay, there was a lot that I didn't know, and it wasn't my fault that I didn't know. And there's a lot that people still don't know today, and it's not their fault that they don't know. People only know if they're educated. And so I guess I feel this compulsion to keep educating, to keep researching, to keep speaking, just so that somebody might view the world a little bit differently, a little bit more compassionately, and a little bit more from a human rights perspective, that women have the right not to be exploited. The women have the right to be treated equally, and being treated equally includes freedom from exploitation, freedom from sexual exploitation. That's so vital in my mind. And I just find it so frustrating that so many people don't get it.
I appreciate your openness and your, you know, ability to be vulnerable with myself and our listeners. If Kara could see everything that you're doing to honor her and all the ways that you've honored her and others, what do you believe, Kathy, that she would say to you?
I don't know. I think she'd rather be alive.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. I know she appeared to me, well, probably about a week after she died, because we don't know for sure when she died. And I said, you know, Kara, where have you been? I've been so worried. And she said, Mom, you worry too much. Yeah. And I sort of remember that sometimes. And so I think, do I worry too much? I think her gift was to say, enjoy life, mm-hmm. enjoy life, and help other people enjoy life. So I try to keep that in mind as well. Mm-hmm. So different people believe different things about the spirit. And I think she'd wished I'd done it better 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel quite congruent to say that she would be proud of me, because bottom line is I think she'd rather be alive. Right. And I think that is true of the thousands of women, mm-hmm. and probably hundreds of thousands of women around the world who have been mistreated and killed and who disappear in the name of exploitation, in the name of femicide, in the name of God knows what all. And we are still claiming our, mm-hmm. our rights as full class citizens, and that any society that designates one gender or one status to be subservient to another gender or status is totally missing the boat on human rights.
As you know, I have a teenage daughter.
Yes.
And I guess my question to you is, my daughter has grown up in a movement. I was pregnant, starting walks and doing things before she was even born. But now, as I see her blossoming into this young woman, you know, we at times butt heads.
Oh, I know.
And we're not in the hood anymore. We live in a suburban area. Yeah. But she's been followed by two different men in our area. And I don't want her to live in fear, but I also need her to be aware of the dangers out there. So I do try to educate her, things that were never passed down to me, because she does take the transit. Yeah. Sometimes men my age will approach her and try to start conversation with her. Sometimes it's as much as, oh, what time is it? They'll give her a compliment. And I tell her, you do not have to give this person the time of day.
Right.
You owe him nothing.
Yeah.
If he gives you a compliment, you ignore it.
Yeah.
You owe him nothing. And I think, I don't know, like I find myself worrying a lot.
Of course. Of course. Yeah.
Because of my own experiences.
Yeah.
Because you have shared your story with me, and I've had other bereaved mothers and fathers share their stories over the years, right? Even knowing like my own mother's guilt of not being there for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom left me homeless in Edmonton at 17, and I went to Catholic Social Services, and they basically gave me a food stamp and showed me the door, and I didn't end up in the system, but I did end up in the sex trade. So I really appreciate you mentioning one of those key factors is the housing, right? Could you give mothers like me any advice, like how to kind of find that balance? Like, you don't want to scare the heck out of them.
No.
They need to be aware of the dangers. Right.
Yeah. Just parenting is so different these days. I just love the parenting that I see on Facebook, like the happy birthday to the most amazing, you know, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old. There's so much positive reinforcement in good parenting. And maybe there was 30 years ago, but I hadn't learned it and I didn't embody it as much as I wish I could have. So when I see other parents doing that these days, I'm just thinking, oh, that is so cool. So that's what we need to keep doing. Like the 101 ways to reinforce, you know, self-esteem, safety, boundaries, but a sense of themselves. I think, you know, just to say you are a worthy person, these are your rights, and to know that you will always have a safe place, and to sort of create safety for them, and to build their self-esteem, and to build their repertoire of skills, and to monitor their friends, and to make sure that they are experiencing the alternative, that the alternative is so good that they wouldn't be tempted to follow a questionable path.
Right.
You know, and I mean, that's an idealistic answer, but I think that's what we need to do, is not so much focus on what to be afraid of, but just these are the things you want. If you're not getting them, then it's, you know, as well as the normal, like don't talk to strangers and that sort of thing. Avoid conflict. I mean, that's sort of one of my regrets looking back is like, how did I end up in a conflictual relationship? I'm not a conflictual person. You know, just to sort of continually hone those peacemaking skills within the home and just help your, like not just you, but everybody, just help your daughter process the world that she's experiencing. I had a flashback when you were saying about people approaching your daughter on the transit. I remember another friend who said a guy was hitting on her when she was getting gas for her car, like at Superstore. And she said, like, can't you see that I'm married and pregnant? And the guy said, well, I thought maybe you were a single parent. You know, like, and so like, they're out there. They are out there, and we have to be aware that they're out there.
I think social media, as much as it can be a tool and a weapon, there is more awareness. I had the privilege a few weeks ago of going and supporting Survivor Sister Angela Morris. She was a part of a presentation, and their audience was girls aged 12 to 16, I believe. And I was just so moved being there. The girls kind of trickled in and it was in the morning on a Sunday, but they had excellent turnout. There was such a diverse group of young women. Some came by themselves with parental consent because some came with their parents and guardians. The only thing that I would have loved to have seen, though, also is I didn't see any Indigenous girls.
Oh, okay.
But there was, it was a very diverse group of young ladies. Yeah. And I think as we are continuing to be the Okeechitawak, the warrior women fighting against sexual exploitation, and we're not going to save everybody.
No.
But if we can start planting those seeds of prevention early on so that they understand, hey, maybe this guy, maybe he isn't my boyfriend.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm being used, and I heard about this thing called love bombing. And I heard about the dangers on the internet. And I think this kind of doesn't feel right. And I need to work on my boundaries because I know what boundaries are. I'm telling you, when I was my daughter's age, I didn't know the word boundary. If anything, I was raised to believe that if Uncle so-and-so wants you to sit on his lap, then you sit on his lap. And I come from a generation where kids, I'm sure it's happening still, but maybe less, where kids are forced to give kisses to relatives and friends. Kids have rights too.
Right? No, I'm never comfortable if somebody forces a child to give me a hug or a kiss. I love getting hugs and kisses, but only if the child is comfortable.
Definitely.
Yeah. And then I guess the other big, big, big important part is to educate the young man.
Definitely.
Just to say, and there was something on the Facebook like about 2 weeks ago, came from Melissa Farley, I think, but it was about a video clip about educating men, you know, and it was about a young man who made some stupid remark about, if I bring a box of beer to a party, do you think I can get this girl to get down on her knees? And his three friends said, hey, Betty, that's not cool. And I thought, that's the kind of education we need, is for men to get the message and men to talk to other men. And I've heard of that. Some of the things I've heard are unbelievable. Like the kinds of things that happen at parties.
Yeah, especially
in
today's age and technology,
where everybody thinks that because it's such a hypersexualized world that we're living in. I mean, you and I both remember, you know, when we started knowing what it was to be a sexual person. And I mean, the need to experiment is there, and or not the need, the desire to experiment. So we all go through that very vulnerable period of just figuring out what we're comfortable with and what we're not comfortable with. And it just seems like there's so much pressure on kids to be more sexual than is healthy for them. I mean, yes, we need to educate our daughters one by one, but we also need to tackle it at a larger level, to say, what would you do if that was happening at a party you went to?
Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we've talked about this because you've mentored me over the years about kind of going back to our Indigenous roots of the value that our sexuality, that's something very sacred.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
so, and tapping back into those traditional roles of women being the sacred life givers, but also the men in their traditional roles as being protectors.
Just protected, yes, exactly. Right? And that was the clash when Canada was colonized and the European women were very much objectified and second class.
I think we may need another podcast to start talking about the colonial sexualized, racialized violence against indigenous people.
Yes, or the European tradition, which was not the most healthy example of women. Well, and then the cruelty that was part of child rearing. And again, not everybody was cruel, but a lot of people were cruel. Mm-hmm. I was going through some of my mother's stuff, and there was this little book about Care of the Baby, 1948. And my cousin looked at it and she laughed and she said, Care of the Baby, 1948. It probably says, if the baby cries, slap it.
Right? Yeah. And I thought, give it some whiskey or something.
Like, and I thought, you know, it's sad, but it's funny, but it's more sad than funny. But that was the era that we grew up in. Right. And like, I assume that's, I'm blaming the European tradition for that. Certainly wasn't indigenous tradition. I think as a society, we're getting better at raising children. Or at least we're not as cruel about raising children.
Right.
So I think positive reinforcement of children is better than it was when for me growing up anyway.
You reminded me of something that the director of CEASE, John West, had shared with me and gave me a different perspective often when we're having these discussions around violence and colonization and decolonization. Certain moments in history come up, and I forget exactly how her and I got on the topic of the transatlantic slave trade. But she pointed something out that I think largely needs to be recognized by society, is that was a horrific, completely shameful part of our history. But let's pull back a layer of that onion. When we talk transatlantic slave trade, we're talking about labor trafficking and sex trafficking.
Both, yes, for sure.
And I've said it many times. Unfortunately, there's still some states south of the border that celebrate Columbus Day. But slowly things are changing.
Yeah.
Slowly, less and less states are celebrating a documented known rapist, pedophile, and murder, right?
Yeah,
so I think... Yeah. We just have to keep having these conversations.
Just keep having it,
not leaving our children out of these conversations. Obviously, topics need to be very age appropriate
for obvious reasons. Yeah.
What would you say to, because we know our listeners are not all going to be maybe understanding of the message that we're trying to convey.
Right.
If there was a young woman listening today that was being sold and being trafficked and maybe not aware, what type of advice could you give to this person if they had any curiosity about exiting and doing something different with their lives? What message would you give to that person?
Well, I would just say, to explore what that is. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's such a hard question, because how do you give hope to the hopeless? And I was just at a gathering this afternoon where there was a young man who was, what would you call him, who was caught up in street life and addictions. He was stumbling about with a group. He was not excluded from the gathering because he was a family member, but he was obviously, would be the word, he was obviously disadvantaged because he was, it just was a very, very lost soul. I mean, that's what the girl you would describe, I would also describe as a lost soul. And I'm chatting with him briefly, and I'm just, this question of how do you give somebody a vision beyond the entrapment of their very sad life? So if somebody's feeling objectified and sold and hopeless, it's just, what would you like to see for yourself? What could be different for you, and what would you need to get there? I mean, that's, we can't give people a vision. We have to sort of draw people's vision from themselves.
Right.
So I guess it would be just to say, if this isn't what you want, what would you want? Mm-hmm. You know, what would be different for you? What could be different for you? Because unfortunately or fortunately, they do have to draw from their own depth of experience.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's very powerful. Thank you for that. I know I've shared quite a bit in interviews and other areas. It wasn't my family that saved me. It was community. The only reason why I was able to stay exited, because I was very close to going back to New York City. Being on a bus, a city bus, and seeing an ad for then Pave, now CEASE, I could see myself reflected
in that ad. Okay.
And then contacting them, having the courage to contact them.
Yeah.
And they had these peer-led, survivor-led sharing circles.
Okay.
And then just having that support, having that anchor, if you will.
Yes.
To stay exited and to talk with people that could speak my language, they knew, because they were also
had been
in my situation.
And
then I've met incredible community mothers like yourself and the Kate Quinn, and then my community sisters, Juanita Murphy, who was a huge inspiration to me. If I could go back into time and could hear some of those messaging. Mm-hmm. Yes, this happened to you, but you're not defined by what has occurred.
Right.
And having more of an understanding of how I ended up where I ended up. There is a community out here across Canada and beyond that are wanting to help and have the compassion.
Right. Yeah.
And have resources.
And I guess that's part of it. Yeah. It's just to continually to advertise that so that people know it's there. I mean, it's like with my young man who's stumbling about. I mean, there is Al-Anon, there is multiple supports for addictions.
Right.
So it's not that the support is lacking, but the question is still, how do you reach into the soul of someone who feels lost?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard question. Yeah. And how do you give them that hope that they're confident or at least they're hopeful about taking a step forward. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, like definitely. I remember the first time, this would be a few months after being exited and getting connected with Cease and volunteering in the community, having that realization that I have a regular job, air quotes.
Yeah.
And I don't have to be sold to men to survive.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm working two jobs and I'm making minimum wage, but how empowering is that?
Yeah, yeah.
That another strange and often scary man will not see me naked unless I decide, right? Now I have a choice.
Yeah.
And that's powerful.
But I mean, to have the choice, I think that to know that there is a choice, if the young person doesn't feel they have a choice, then that diminishes their hope. But to sort of create, as you say, communities, safe houses, safe whatever, peer groups, whatever, so that possibility of safety, a possibility of connection on another level is there.
Definitely.
So that people who reach out can find it. That's what we need. Yeah.
This is my last question for today's interview. Just in closing, Kathy, in your dream vision, what would a safer and more compassionate future for young girls and women look like?
Okay. Well,
dream as you want.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a world in which women can do whatever the women have full equality to explore and develop their careers to the best of their ability, that women who don't have the ability do not have to compromise themselves to be cared for. I mean, this all has to do with basic security, I mean, which a certain amount of it's in place already. I mean, that's the positive things, that women have equal shared vision and that there's no discrimination between gender or sex about aspirations, but also that respect and compassion is somehow taught, and that we treat each other with respect. And treating each other with respect does not mean buying them.
Right.
You know, that women's sexuality is something to be treasured and cherished and celebrated and not monetized and not objectified. Part of it is just a return to the sacredness too, because our whole society has become so materialistic and commercialized. And sometimes I think we've lost the sense of sacredness within ourselves and within relationships and within the world. So just to sort of have that full nurturing complement of education and experience, that we can all grow up feeling safe and cherished and respected and encouraged. I mean, that's very idealistic, but it's
beautiful.
It reminds
me of a very famous song. I think it was from the 90s, Return to Innocence.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That came to mind.
Yeah.
Well, I very much am honored to have shared this time with you, my dear. Your strength, your voice, Kathy, your love for Kara ripple out further than you may ever know. Thank you for being here today and for honoring Kara through action and for inspiring all of us to see the human stories behind the headlines.
This was an excerpt from the Red Light Exposé podcast. We're an international group of survivors and other experts seeking to shed a light on commercial sexual exploitation. If you're interested in hearing this episode in full and or more related audio content, you can find us at redlightexposé.com.